What makes the NCAA basketball tournament so compelling each year are the buzzer beaters and the Cinderellas. 30 years ago, the 1987 championship game ended with a late basket from a player who enjoyed his own Cinderella story. Keith Smart scored 17 second-half points against Syracuse, the last two giving the Indiana Hoosiers a 74-73 victory and a fifth national title. Less than 2 years before his shining moment, the Baton Rouge native was playing for Garden City Community College in Kansas, having very little high school basketball experience.
First off, didn't play high school basketball. Played a couple games my senior year, broke my wrist, and didn't get a chance to go off to school anywhere. My best friend was going to school at Garden City Community College, and the next semester, he said, "Hey, man, why don't you just come go to school out here?" And I went to school out there as a student. And at the end of the year, they had an open tryout, and I went to the tryout and played pretty well in the tryout and got invited back and ended up winning a scholarship out at Garden City Community College and played pretty well out there, Junior College All-American and Player of the Year in that conference and everything, and caught the eye of Indiana. But I had a really nice career out there in the Western Plains and met some great people, had a great coach, Jim Carey, and another coach by the name of Kent Davison, someone that I communicate with today after all those years. But they put me on the right track of trying to become a college student athlete.
Were there any other schools that had your eye? I mean, was it always Indiana, at the time when you were doing well?
No. Indiana was one school that I never thought I would go to. I saw Indiana play LSU, and I'm from Baton Rouge. Mm-hmm. Played in the Final Four, and I saw that, and I saw Isaiah, and I just knew that Indiana was going to be a place for me to go play. But as I started to play and more, Indiana became one of my five schools that I was getting recruited by, and KU, Kansas University, University of Kansas, Arkansas, North Carolina State, Georgetown, and then Indiana. And so those were the schools, but I only visited Arkansas, KU, and Indiana. Once I went to Indiana, I knew that's where I wanted to go. And it's funny how Indiana started recruiting me. They were playing against a team in my conference called Barton County. We were playing a team. And Indiana just happened to be there that game. And already going to Indiana was Todd Jadlow and a guy named Andre Harris. And I just so happened to have a really good game that particular night. And from there, I got onto Indiana's recruiting radar and then got recruited the rest of the way.
Yeah, and to Bloomington, of course, during the time you were there, the predominant figure was Bob Knight, who upon your arrival had won two national championships and had already reached Hall of Fame status. What was your initial impression of Coach Knight, and what do you think his initial impression was of you?
Well, I'll tell you, the first time that I met him, he came out to Garden City, Kansas, and I remember we were playing as a team called Hutchinson Community College, where they played the national championship, junior college national championship games in Hutchinson, Kansas. And when I came into the locker room, I saw Coach Carey, the head coach. He was talking, but he was facing me as I walked into the locker room. And I didn't know, unbeknownst to me, I didn't know Coach Knight was there. And so for that game, it was kind of a big game for us. A lot of the players been a bear cut in a certain way and put little numbers or parts in our head for that particular game. And at that time, you used to have this goal on the rope, really fake goal on the rope. Like Mr. T was real popular at that time. So we all had all these gold chains, but this was really fake chains. And when I came around the corner into the locker room and I saw Coach Knight, and he looked at me and I looked at him, and it was like, oh, shucks, what do I do? But he never said anything about that. And I met him for the first time and talked, and he watched me play in that game that particular night. And then I obviously got recruited by them. When I came for my visit to Indiana, he said, "Hey, we got a chance. We got a center that's going to be coming here from California, Dean Garrett. And we need a guard that can kind of blend with a player that we already have and offered to form a pretty good backcourt, we believe. And we think you could be that guy to help us be on track to win a national championship." And a lot of coaches have said that hey, we're going to have a chance to go to the tournament, may have a chance to. No one ever said win a championship, though. And he was one of them that said that. And so when I came on my visit to Indiana, I fell in love with IU, and I knew I wanted to go there.
So in 1986-87, your first year, the Hoosiers win the Big Ten regular season championship and went into the tournament, the NCAA tournament, as a number one seed. With a situation like that, a team that good that had, I think, three of your four losses came against ranked opponents and it played a tough schedule in the Big Ten, was the feeling going into the tournament a championship or bust mentality?
Well, I think when we started off, you know, Coach – throughout the whole season, just said we weren't a good basketball team. And yet we were, you know, just racking up wins. But he was saying we're not a good basketball team. I think he tried to keep us on the edge so we never got ahead of ourselves. And then once we kind of went through the season, went through the Big Ten, and then eventually got to the tournament, Coach really stopped, not stopped coaching us, but he stopped really pushing the buttons, because I think he had saw that we had arrived at being a very, very good basketball team. And then, of course, all of us were upperclassmen, Rick Callaway being a sophomore, but everyone else was juniors and seniors. And so I think that he understood that we had an idea and an identity that we had created now, that he didn't have to push the buttons as much as he had that he had done early on. And in coaching, that's what you do. You push the buttons real hard early on for your concepts to be developed and your habits to be developed. And then eventually when you get to the time where you're trying to play for championships, those habits have already been formed. And I think that's what it was with us, with that group as we got down into the tournament time.
So after defeating Fairfield in the first round, beating Auburn in the round of 32, then Duke by 6 points in the Sweet 16, and LSU by 1 point in the Elite Eight after a late basket by Rick Callaway, you head into the Final Four, which that year was held in Louisiana Superdome in New Orleans. And as you said, personally, that had to be a thrill for you being a native of Baton Rouge.
Well, you know, one, playing LSU first was great, because a lot of those guys I played pickup basketball with in the summer times, you know, with those players from LSU. We played at the Sports Academy in Baton Rouge. I played at on campus at LSU. So that was always good bragging rights to play against LSU, then beat them. And I've never forget seeing one of the news streams that showed when we won the game, and it was at my house, at my mom's house in Baton Rouge, and relatives were all over watching that game. And I never forget my aunt screaming out, "We're going to the Final Four. We're going to the Final Four," you know, as if they knew they had tickets or something like that. But I remember that moment and seeing that on that newscast when we beat that one against LSU, and now heading to the Final Four, being right there in my backyard. I had a lot of cousins and uncles that lived in New Orleans. My dad's brothers lived in New Orleans. So it would be great going home to play in this particular game. And from where I had come from, to having a chance to be on that stage of all times where the tournament is played is right, you know, up the highway from my hometown.
So in the semifinals, national semifinals, you guys win 97-93 over UNLV. And that put you in the championship, national championship against Syracuse. There were a lot of players that, of course, contributed and helped lead you to that championship game. Foremost among them was your backcourt mate, Steve Alford, that season's Big Ten Player of the Year. Was a true fan favorite, being a native of Indiana. And he certainly directly benefited from the institution of the three-point line. Everyone today knows and sees how much it's utilized in both the college and pro game. But it was brand new to the tournament in 1987. Talk about his importance throughout the year, and especially in that championship game against Syracuse, in which I think he hit seven three-pointers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I think we'd be starting off the season, once we knew the three-point line had been implemented, Coach would say to him, "I don't want you coming inside the three-point line taking shots. You know, maybe you have a clear-cut layup, but I don't want you inside the line." And the way that he could shoot already, that line just never was a factor for him. And with the ability to shoot like that and the ability to move to get to those spots for those kind of shots just made our team that much more formidable as far as what we were able to do on the floor. Me being able to penetrate, Callaway was a penetrator. You know, Dean could rebound, offensive rebound, kick out to passes to an open threes as well. So as he moved through the tournament, moved through the season, moved through the tournament, and then get to the moment of being able to make shots and keep us in games or win games, that was huge for us. You know, maybe the season doesn't go quite as the way we wanted it to go if the three-point line wasn't there. We would still have been a good team and probably would have still got there anyway because we were still a good team. And but the three-point line definitely enhanced our chances of winning the whole thing.
Yeah, in that championship game, Indiana had a 1-point lead at halftime. But early in the second half, after an errant pass, you were taken out by Coach Knight.
Ball out of bounds on the turnover. That's six.
That made Knight hot. He's going to take Smart out of the ballgame. Now, Bobby getting a little impatient there with Keith Smart.
And Joe Hillman back in the game. Smart sits down. He sat quite a bit against Las Vegas, you'll recall, on Saturday afternoon.
Did you think from that point on that your role was going to be significantly diminished?
Oh, yeah, because when I made that pass, which I blamed Darryl Thomas for not going where I was passing the ball, but when Darryl made a cut, we always kind of threw passes to areas where the cutter was going to be. And that particular time, Derek Coleman held Darryl Thomas up, so he couldn't get to the spot where I was making the pass. And the ball sailed out of bounds, and I was removed from the game. And I just felt, well, okay, you know, this may not be the way I wanted to go. But the assistant coaches, Joby Wright, Ron Fellings, those coaches, Con Smith, those coaches all say, keep your head in the game. You're going to get back in the game. Stay focused. Remain in the game. And my teammates, Todd Meyer, you know, one of the seniors who wasn't playing a lot, you know, was saying, stay ready, stay ready. And so I was able to stay focused in the game, and I just knew that if I got that opportunity to get back in the game, being at home with my family all there, that I was going to go back in and play at a certain level. And then when Coach called my name and asked me if I was ready, and he said, I'm giving you a few minutes to go into play. And if you're not doing anything in a few minutes, I'm taking you out. If I take you out, then I'm not going to be able to use you in this basketball game. And so I obviously went back in the game and played at a level that was needed. And he shared something with me about when Steve came out of the game and I wasn't as aggressive. That was kind of in the first half, you know, and he needed me to be a little bit more aggressive as we played through the second half. And I was able to respond.
Yeah, absolutely. Scoring, I think it was 17 of your 21 points came in the second half, including some critical baskets down the stretch. After you hit a short jump shot with about 30 seconds to go, to bring Indiana within one at 73-72, and then you fouled Derek Coleman, the freshman star, to put him on the line for a 1-1. Coach Knight called a timeout, probably to ice him. What do you remember about that discussion in the huddle? Was there a play? Were there multiple plays drawn up?
No, there was no plays drawn up. It was nothing that we were going to run our normal offense. It wasn't a play designed for anyone. Because we play out of motion offense, and we take what the defense was going to give us. And obviously, we look at Steve to see what he's going to be doing. They switched and put Douglas on Alford as he was being chased off screens. So it wasn't anything that we said, let's look at this. And now as I'm into coaching, I think sometimes when you, in a timeout, say, this is where I want the ball to go, the players have a tendency to become tunnel vision, and they focus only on that. And I think when by him not directing us as to where the ball needed to go, but take what's available, it allowed us to play into a free type setting so that when the defense made the mistake, we were going to do the right things. And now having played all year long, finally having the opportunity to be able to adjust to each of our players on the floor. And when the defense made a mistake, because that was the hardest thing for me when I first came to Indiana, was that we read the defense. Don't pay attention to what your offense is going to do. They've been trained to do certain things. So you focus on what the defense is going to do. And when you do that, it keeps your mind open to the game. And I was able to go back in and make the play. Once we got back on the floor, we ran out of motion offense. We looked for Steve a couple times. He didn't have anything. And then finally we went inside to Darryl Thomas, or I passed it to Darryl Thomas. And then, as a senior and a guy with a tremendous amount of leadership, he didn't force a shot. He could have taken it upon himself and tried to force that shot up, but he didn't have it. He threw it back out. We didn't panic, and I was able to take a shot. And Ron Felling, something that he would always say, was jump up, shoot up. And I had taken a shot from the other side of the floor a little bit earlier, and I didn't have enough lift on the ball, the shot. And I knew that if I got it again, that I was going to take that mantra that Felling used to always say, jump up, shoot up. To put automatic arc on the ball, and that's exactly what I did. The other part was relocate, don't stand. And I knew when I passed into Darryl, I relocated, and Howard Trish ended up coming back to the spot that I was originally in, but I had already moved to a different position, which I was able to get a clean shot off.
Smart takes the shot, and the Hoosiers with 3 seconds. Go ahead.
Nobody stopped the clock.
but the clock did stop at the 1 second mark. Syracuse with a timeout. Keith Smart with 17 points in the second half has moved the Hoosiers to within 1 second of a national championship.
So yeah, after that, Coleman had missed the front end of the 1-1, so that gave you a chance to read a 2-point shot would have won the game, and that's certainly what you did. That sequence, you know, you had just described it, but was, you know, what went through your mind, if anything, in those moments that led up to it? I mean, is it where your just mind is you're concentrating so much that you really don't everything surrounding you, the crowd, a large crowd, just kind of is put to the back burner?
Well, yeah, because, you know, you hear athletes talk all the time about being in the zone. And I got into that position. I got into that zone. And when you get into a zone of either running, long-distance runners, I read about them being into a zone to where the only thing they hear are their feet hitting the pavement. You know, I heard of other zones where players, baseball players, you know, can pick out, can see the grains on the baseball are spinning as it's being hurled to the plate. And then various other things, you know, a tight spiral being thrown, and football players can see when they get into the zone. And I think I was in that zone, because when I went back into the game and I started playing how I was playing, I didn't hear anything. I didn't see anything. I didn't see people. I didn't see no other player on the floor but myself. And so I was able to make, and seemed like I had unlimited time to make all the right plays at that time in the game. And while I'm making those plays, and I go back and look at sometime with film, and I'll see, you know, if I would have told Joe Hillman to go to the left side of the floor as opposed to waving him to the right, you know, or as I'm dribbling the ball down the floor and one extra dribble and there's a deflection where the ball is knocked from behind by Colton when I made the little pull-up jump shot. So all those little things there. But when you're in the zone, you don't see that. Everything is slow motion. But yet the game is moving, obviously, but you're in slow motion. And so I was able to make a lot of decisions based on being in that environment to where I didn't see the crowd and hear the crowd. Only time I heard the crowd was when the ball went through the basket and I heard the explosion of noise. That was when I came back from wherever I was to be in that moment.
And after that shot, there was still 1 second left, but Syracuse tried a long inbounds pass, and you intercepted it, fittingly, end the game. And I think you threw the ball up in the air instead of, I guess maybe you could have had a memento, you know, you could have held on to
it. It's a strange thing, though, with that pass. You know, one, I noticed that Coleman being a lefty and him having a passing ball with his right hand. So I knew the ball was going to have a tendency to curve. And I was able to get over the area and rebound the basketball. I get the steal. And then when I threw the ball in the stands, believe it or not, the ball went 3 seats above where my family was sitting. I had no idea where they were sitting in the arena. But my brothers later told me that the ball went right up over their head and some gentleman got the ball. And I heard that Coach Knight ended up getting that ball back, but it hasn't been confirmed, but that's what I'd heard.
But he guard puts nobody on Coleman. Here it goes.
Indiana wins the championship. Keith Smart is the hero.
It probably took a while for it all to sink in, but it had to be just an amazing feeling to go from, you know, barely playing high school basketball to a community college player, to not just a member of the championship team, but the most outstanding player, and the guy who hits the basket. I mean, it's kind of a Cinderella story.
Oh, without a question, there was a statement that Billy Packer made one night that both he and Brent Musburger had made. There's a lot of McDonald All-Americans on this floor. And I was doing the tournament, I think it might have been against UNLV. And he said, and there's one guy who worked at a McDonald's, because I worked at a McDonald's in high school. So so looking at that situation of going and being in that environment, I mean, I practiced that shot thousands of times. You know, we would always play basketball. And then at the end of playing, back when I was growing up, Nicholson Elementary School, Northdale Elementary School, the place that we always played, when we were getting ready to go home before it got dark, we would always take a baseline jump shot and fall out of bounds. And falling out of bounds, because in most high schools, obviously, the cheerleaders were all on the baseline. And so we wanted to always take a shot and fall into the arms of the cheerleaders on the baseline. That was the theme, you know. And so when I went up and had that drift type shot moving to my left and ended up out of bounds, it was, I had seen that moment thousands of times, but never ever believing that I would get to that moment. I remember in when we were in and I was in college and having a chance to see Michael Jordan make his shot, you know, and looking at that and seeing that, you know, this guy just won the championship, you know, hit a game-winning shot. And I just thought maybe one day I'll be able to do that, but never thinking that I had the opportunity to go to college. And when my friend asked me to come go to school with him, that started that that trigger to me getting to that point in New Orleans.
Yeah, and hitting the shot almost in the same spot that, that Jordan did in 82.
Yeah, it was. There was a photo in Sports Illustrated that had almost the same spot, same side of the floor, wearing number 23, and in the same building. You know, so it was all those things for that particular moment to come together. How much had to go into me having the chance to be in that place, and it was with our team, that team that we played, that we had that year. Everyone had a moment to where they played big during the course of the year to get us to that point. You know. Dean Garrett, Joe Hillman, everyone had a chance during the course of the season to win games, you know, to win big games for us, to get us in that position, to get us a number one seed, to get us close to home, to start playoff, you know, and everything that went into our growth of our team. And the interesting thing was when we finished the game and went into the locker room, it was as if we were getting ready for the next game. Who do we play next? Because it didn't seem like we had finally won it. Sure, we knew we had won it. Yes, we had cut the nets down and everything. And something that Coach Knight said to us when we got back in there, and he said, you know, you guys have no idea what you've done. Yeah, yes, you know you won the championship, yes. But it won't really start sinking in until 15, 20, 30 years from now when you're sitting there with your kids or your grandkids or whatever it might be, and when they see the tournament and they can say that when my dad or grandpa played in that tournament, we won it. You know, they won it. And I'll never forget my little brother, my youngest brother, you know, heard them say, and Keith Smart's the hero, and ran through the house shouting that. When I had my kids, and finally when they were old enough to start seeing some of the reruns prior to the tournament, and they would see me in the shorts and things like that and look at that and say, boy, you know, look at the first they noticed the shorts that we wore, how short they were. But then they look at, you know, that shot that I made and things like that. So it was a great moment for everyone that that helped me get to where I was at that moment there. Because a lot of people helped me get to college, getting me a guy named Lester Roberts who saw me for the first time when I walked into the Sports Academy in Baton Rouge, and I'm playing pickup basketball every day, and he came over to me and said, you see what's on your t-shirt? And I said, no, what do you see? I just a white t-shirt on. And he said, you have can't miss on your shirt. And he was so positive. I mean, guy influenced me so much. He said, you have can't miss. He said, son, how would you like to go to school and have a chance to play basketball? And I didn't know anything else. I just said, yeah, I want to do it. And then hadn't talked to my parents, had no idea how I was going to pay for it. But I said yes, and he made a phone call to the coach out of Garden City. And that's how it all started.
It's amazing how many people can help you, lead you to that one moment. Mm-hmm. Knowing how fervent the fan base is in the state of Indiana with regards to its basketball teams, and mm-hmm. as we're talking, you're in Indianapolis right now with the right. Grizzlies getting ready to play the Pacers. Have you had to buy a meal in Indiana since making the shot?
You know, once people figure me out, you know, see who I am and things like that, you know, I kind of get a freeway here somewhere. But for the most part, you know, when I come in town, it's so quickly. I normally try to go down and see my in-laws. They still live in Bloomington. My father-in-law still teaches there in Indiana. He's retired, but he still teaches tax law at the law school. Or I try to stop by the university when I have time. And so then I get back at the hotel, obviously the hotel that we've stayed in all my years of coaching the NBA. A lot of people here know me when I come in town and I see the name on my bag or stuff like that, break the bags to my room when we arrive and get a conversation. And they always say, man, when you made that shot, this is what I was doing, you know, or I've either made people money or lost them money, you know. I had one story where I met a gentleman one time. I was in the airport flying back to Indianapolis, and I met a gentleman. He said, I want to tell you a story. My daughter was begging me so much, you know, during the course of the game, bothering me so much during the course of that game. And I told her, she always wanted a horse. And I told her, if you let me finish watching this game, I'll get you that horse. And when you made that shot, you know, and I had a chance to watch that game, and you made that shot, I knew I had to get her that horse. Well, I saw this person, this gentleman, probably about 15 years later, both he and his daughter. And he said, I know you probably don't remember this, but I spoke to you a while back, and I told you about my daughter and the horse. And this is my daughter grown up, and she did get that horse. You know, so all types of stories have come from that moment that we had in New Orleans.
Yeah, one last question for you, Keith. Now, as a coach, both as being an assistant coach and a head coach in the NBA now almost 20 years, what lessons specifically from Coach Knight that he taught you as a player have you used in your coaching career?
Well, I'll tell you, when I got ready to get into coaching, I was still playing, and Coach Knight wanted me to come back to Indiana. You know, he's always said, when you're done playing, I want you to come here and be an assistant coach with me. And then I said, I still love playing. So one day I was in Atlanta. My wife and I was living in Atlanta in the off season, and he called me up and said, hey, I need to talk to you. And I came up and he said, okay, look, this is what I want you to do. It's enough of that playing basketball. I want you to get here, and you're going to play. You're going to be one of my assistant coaches. And this is how you're going to go out recruiting, and then I'll come in and we'll do our recruiting together. And at the same time, I was still playing in Europe. Had a contract to go back. And my wife, we wanted to have getting ready to have our first child. And she didn't want to have the baby over in Europe. She just wanted, just in case there were complications, she wanted to be around family. So I came back and decided to play. You know, I tried out for the Clippers and then decided to stay in the States. And if I didn't make it, we're going to stay in the States. And I ended up going to Fort Wayne, Indiana, and playing in Fort Wayne. And played that year, player coached that year. The head coach was ill, so I ended up becoming a player coach. And then the next year, they wanted me to be the head coach. And I went to Coach Knight, and he still wanted me to come back over to Indiana. And he said, look, I'll tell you what, I think this might be a good situation for you because you've been out of school for a long time now, and a lot of your peers are already into their second tier of coaching. You might want to take this head coaching position because you'll get experience. And then once you got that experience, you know, you can't take that away from it. You have it as a head coach. And if you don't like it, you can come here with me. And obviously I went to Fort Wayne and coached up there and stayed on the pro side. But he said, one thing you better make sure you do, make sure you organize and you're prepared. Because if you struggle coaching and if you're not organized, you won't come out of the struggles. But if you organize, you'll come out of those. And so more than anything, it's the preparation, being organized, be able to move from a moment in practice to the next moment. Don't use a lot of wasted time. Focus on your team because your team is the team that you scout the most. And I see today we have lost that instinct. You know, we have lost that ability, what the older coaches used to do. They used to focus on what their team need to be doing. And so I learned those things, and I've applied that every place I've been, every place I've gone, to really focus on our team. Respect your opponent, but really you need to be coaching your team as much as you can.
All right. Excellent, Keith. Well, it was really great to speak with you. Thanks so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Okay, no problem, man. Appreciate you.
To listen to more episodes, including interviews with Mario Andretti, Ken Burns, and Jack Hamm, among others, subscribe to the Profiles in Sports podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, Google Play, and elsewhere. Also, please check out our website, profilesinsports.com, as well as our Facebook page. And lastly, you can follow me on Twitter, @BrianWright86.